You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Rosalind English.
Hello, LawPodders. I trust you've had a good summer break. And here is, for a start of our new season, our annual roundup of the best of LawPod UK episodes from the past few months. Everyone's talking about AI at the moment, even though it's been catapulting through its various iterations over the past few years. As LawPod listeners will know, we have kept a close eye on the potential effect it will have on the law profession, the operation of the law, and justice, even before all litigation went online in response to the COVID pandemic. So we thought it was high time to talk to someone who has been advising the legal profession on computer power since the days of Amstrads, telexes, and fax machines. Professor Richard Susskind, technological advisor to the Lord Chief Justice, came into our virtual studio with a generally optimistic view of how this is going to work for the legal profession.
Lawyers traditionally have been conservative in relation to technology. I think we saw during COVID, and this really was remarkable, we saw during COVID a fundamental shift in the way in which lawyers and judges worked, and a very rapid shift too. So that suggested to me that it's not that lawyers are incapable of adapting to technology, it's just historically they've enjoyed and the way they've always worked. So it never surprises me that lawyers aren't on top of the latest technologies. However, ChatGPT has been a real eye-opener because it's immediately demonstrable in a way that many other technologies haven't been, that you have a technology there, you just simply sign up, log on, and away you go. Whereas hearing news about a system that plays the board game Go or can analyze the molecular structure of proteins more accurately never really resonates. And so we're seeing, I think, greater interest. But by and large, lawyers are busy people. They're preoccupied with their clients and their businesses. And it's not built in to the daily work of lawyers to keep up with the latest technology. This has to change, in my view. But historically, the work of lawyers has been relatively free of technology other than in the back office for accounting, word processing, and so forth. So the big shift we're seeing now is that these technologies might be used in the actual delivery of legal and court services at the cutting edge of legal work.
As Richard points out, people don't want doctors. They want health. Equally, they don't need lawyers. They want to avoid disputes altogether. Can technology provide, so to speak, the fence at the top of the cliff rather than an ambulance at the bottom? Susskind takes a deep dive into blockchain technology, which we think of only in terms of financial transactions, but which, he claims, is about to become an essential part of the process of discovery and evidence in legal actions.
This is a way that we can have single definitive records of information that have inbuilt authentication, that are inbuilt authoritative and so forth. And so, for example, if you take public registers, this is a wonderful way of having a single, definitive, electronic, reliable, secure online resource. But it goes way beyond that because often for many transactions, many activities online, if they are stored within this thing, blockchain or blockchains, they have the same characteristic that for evidential purposes in due course, the information stored within them is incontestable. So it brings a level of reliability and solidity to a world where information often seems ephemeral or rather unreliable. And you can see that people want, for example, to take this further with contracts, which they call smart contracts, where the contract itself is stored in this way. And you have this idea of self-executing contracts. So when certain conditions are satisfied, the system automatically takes the next step, which might be the transfer of money. That is recorded on the blockchain, which means it's authoritatively authenticated and people can verify it and so forth. So it brings a level of security and certainty to a lot of our online activities. the blockchain specialist listening to this will think this is a glorious oversimplification, but I want to go back to functional and architectural. Why does it matter to most listeners that we have this bit of kit, this infrastructure? And it's about greater reliability and security and authenticity in a world where we do worry about online truth and reliability of information.
The essential thing to hang on to here is that we shouldn't regard technology as a task substitution function. The way we should view it is as a new creative process.
I often say to people that the competition that kills you doesn't look like you. And it's the same with the technology. The technology that replaces you won't look like you and it won't function like you, but it will solve the problems that the people you help today, it will solve their problems in entirely new ways. So it requires a different mindset. I completely get it because I've spent my whole life speaking to lawyers and other professionals. I completely get it that people think that what they do is not threatened by and large by technology. It's pretty hard, though, with ChatGPT to look at that system and say, this is just a first version. What will it be like in 10 years' time to say that nothing I do might be done differently? So we're at an inflection point. And you may say, well, this is terribly threatening. And for some it is. People often ask, am I optimistic or pessimistic? And I think that very much depends whether or not you're talking about the producer or the recipient of the service. As regards the recipients of service, I can see a glimmer here of how we might crack the access to justice problem. So I'm quite optimistic. If you're a producer and you're unwilling to change the way you work, if you're a lawyer and saying, I'm going to continue working as always I have done, I would be pessimistic for you. But I also think the great opportunities here, in fact, I go beyond that. I think there are great obligations here. I think across the professions, the challenge and the obligation is to build the systems that replace our old ways of working. I don't think the obligation is to streamline and improve our current court system. I think the challenge is to say, what systems might we have in place that could replace our current ways of working that are often antiquated, unaffordable, and inaccessible?
The risks we run by running a law-based news podcast is that often our episodes are overtaken by events. Still, it is sometimes worth dwelling on the issues raised in a particular judgment, even if it is subsequently overruled. Practitioners of the common law in this country are used to the mantra that the imposition of duties of care in negligence should be done slowly, incrementally, and only if it's fair, just, and reasonable to create such liability. A core example of this cautious approach is the principle that the police should not owe a duty of care to potential victims of crime to protect them from that crime. And that principle extends to the so-called duty to warn. Other countries have a so-called Good Samaritan law, which imposes a limited duty under their civil codes on bystanders to rescue. There was a certain amount of litigation following the road accident death of the Princess of Wales in Paris under this provision. But here in the UK, there is no requirement, enforceable by law, on citizens to be those Good Samaritans, and by extension, no obligation on the police force to do anything beyond their original mandate to keep the King's peace. Which is why a recent High Court ruling has caused quite a stir. I talked to an expert in police matters, Barrister Conor Monaghan of 5 Essex Court, about the case of Woodcock and Chief Constable of Northamptonshire. First, a quick sketch of the background facts. The claimant had been in an abusive and coercive relationship with R.G. On the 4th of February 2015, they split up. On the 19th of March of the same year, as the claimant was leaving her home with her two children, she was attacked by RG and stabbed at least 7 times in her chest and body. RG was subsequently convicted of attempted murder and imprisoned for life. But about 12 minutes before the attack, a neighbour had made a 999 call to the defendant to inform them that RG was loitering outside the claimant's house. Officers were dispatched to the address, but were too late to prevent the attack. So, did the police owe the claimant a duty to pass on this warning to her before she went out? Richie J in the High Court decided that they did. Not surprisingly, this ruling is likely to be appealed.
Yeah, so it's very interesting, and I think this is at the heart of the case. So in general, as you say, the police don't owe a duty of care for a failure to act or a failure to prevent harm caused by criminals. And there's lots of cases on that. Perhaps the most important, there are many, but perhaps the most important is Robinson, which is a Supreme Court decision from a few years ago now. And it really draws upon the omissions principle. The omissions principle, as you may know, basically suggests that people shouldn't generally be liable for a failure to act or a failure to confer a benefit on somebody. And as you've said, Rosalind, there are some exceptions to that principle. For example, if the police had assumed a specific responsibility to protect somebody, so a classic example of that would be an informant, for instance, then there might be a duty. There might be exceptional or special circumstances, an informant could again fall into that. And or that it would be an affront to justice if they weren't held accountable. The courts, to my knowledge, have never found a case where it would be an affront to justice to not find that the police were owed a duty of care. And this is, to my knowledge, the first case in which that happened. So to answer your question directly, in this case, the High Court said the police had assumed responsibility and that they had done that by advising her to set up that protective ring around the property, calling the neighbours, etc., as we've talked about. But in the alternative, they said that this was one of those mythical, special, exceptional cases where there was a positive duty to warn.
An affront to justice is quite an exotic shore on which to land liability, where it has never existed before. In this sort of case, the court found that there was a very close tripartite nexus where the claimant relied on the police advice and their safety plan.
It said at paragraph 108, "In my judgment, there would be little point in advising the claimant to ask neighbours to keep watch for RG and to tell the claimant or the police if the police were then going to keep any such information secret from the claimant." So in a way, Rosalind, it's exactly the point that you quite rightly raised at the start. I mentioned public policy, and of course, you'll know that in many cases, public policy historically has been a very significant factor, which has led the courts to decide that the police shouldn't be liable. In this case, they said that public policy actually means abused women should be protected. The effort in passing on the information would have been tiny because they would have just had to have called the claimant and told her. And it also said, and I think personally this is a little bit tenuous, that public confidence in reporting matters to the police would be undermined if the court supported the police's decision not to pass on the information to the claimant in this case.
Connor suggests that this bold step was taken because the court was developing a common law duty akin to the European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence on this point. We all remember the police case, Osman versus the United Kingdom, and that judges may be wanting to strengthen local law in anticipation of this country's withdrawal from the European Convention on Human Rights. Whether this actually happens in the foreseeable future is, of course, a matter for speculation. Now we go back to January this year and the case of Re-X, which concerned the secure accommodation of children who, for mental health issues and others, have to be looked after in conditions that restrict their liberty. This is even more a matter of policy for government and society as a whole rather than for the courts. And this is where I hand over to my co-presenter, Lucy McCann, who called in the family law experts at the Brighton Annex of 1 Crown Office Road to discuss the implications of this case.
There is a gross mismatch between the number of children and young people and secure accommodation and the resources available. It's a distressing case where the child, X, was a 15-year-old girl, an only child who had significant trauma, self-harmed, had suicidal ideation, and whose behaviour had deteriorated since the age of 10. she absconded from school and was charged with assault on members of her family. By the time the case came to court, it was deemed that she was beyond parental control and a risk to herself and others, and she'd been detained in various unregulated placements with restrictions imposed by the High Court's inherent jurisdiction. I asked Richard Ager whether it was usual for the Secretary of State for Education to be a party in such a case.
I think the Secretary of State was brought in by the President, who directed attendance because he was so concerned about the lack of resources, the lack of placements. Sadly, it's not the first time that the Secretary of State has been brought in. The various guises of whatever minister takes responsibility for children's affairs, they have been called in. So many High Court judges and circuit judges have sent their judgments into the Secretary's, criticising the lack of space in the hope that something might be done. Unfortunately, so far, little has been done. And you may have noticed, Lucy, that in this case Re-X, the Secretary of State actually said to the President, "Do we need to be there?" And his response was as explosive as you can get from a president in measured terms.
Yeah, it's fair to say that the judge wasn't impressed with this position maintained by the Secretary of State for Education. His response was, "The lack of secure placements is long-standing and chronic. My view, expressed during the hearing, was that the stance taken by the Department for Education, to the effect that it was not its problem and was the responsibility of individual local authorities, displayed a level of complacency bordering on cynicism. It was, I observed, shocking to see that the Department for Education seemed to be simply washing its hands of this chronic problem."
Claire Chaborowska agreed that government doesn't seem to be hearing these warnings.
Well, I think that's as strongly as you can put it. And I think what he goes on to say is that there are obviously many cases now that have been reported to try and highlight the issue. But the issue is only getting worse. There isn't enough provision for secure accommodation. There aren't enough regulated placements. It's a very scathing assessment of the situation where repeatedly judges are giving these warnings.
Richard and Claire go on to discuss a number of deprivation of liberty cases in the context of young people, and together they make a litany of overt pleas by the courts on a sensitive policy matter. I mentioned that the annual total of so-called DOLS applications may exceed 1,000. Consistency and a fair share of the national resource are both essential to match the increasing demand. Of course, all of those who call on the support of lawyers and the courts require their share of the public budget. We hear increasingly about the need for nature and the environment to also be given a voice in the courts, where until modern times, only human litigants could claim the protection of the law. We have to ask ourselves whether the law is best placed to adjudicate on complex policy areas in the context of the increase in cases against states alleging a failure to intervene appropriately on environmental matters. I pondered this problem with Dr. Stefan Teil, specialist in public law at Cambridge University. Dr. Teil feels that the courts don't have a proper framework for enforcing environmental governance. He advocates using human rights, such as the right to protest or the right to respect for private and enjoyment of property, to be connected in such a way as to underwrite environmental protection with punitive action against environmental harm by the courts. We should not rely, in other words, on a narrow pool of landmark decisions on specific environmental commitments and the causal links between actions and commissions that lead to environmental harm. I asked Dr. Teil why he has so much faith in international climate change agreements as a potential avenue for addressing environmental harm through the courts. He says this enables polycentricity to be considered in such challenges, because otherwise the courts only decide between two adversaries and therefore shoehorn the result into all or nothing conclusions.
So the concept of polycentricity is a really interesting one. It was first articulated and developed by a US legal scholar, Lon Fuller, in the 1960s. The article was then published posthumously. Fuller believed that polycentricity sets hard limits to the appropriateness of legal adjudication of policy questions, particularly when there are resource implications. Now, it's important to note that when Fuller talks about polycentricity and polycentric problems being complex, he doesn't necessarily mean that in a factual or legal sense. The defining characteristic for Fuller of a polycentric issue is that there is an interconnection of multiple issues and stakeholders, and a vast number of individuals ultimately are affected by any decision that is made. That's a bit abstract, so let's take an example. Imagine price negotiations between a car manufacturer and their dealership network. Now, this car manufacturer wants to figure out what the best price is, in quotation marks, to charge for its car. Regardless of what price the dealership network and the car manufacturer ultimately land on, the price that they set affects supply and demand, and that in turn influences a lot of the factors that were taken into account while making the original decision. So things like salaries and wages, the overhead costs of making the car, profit margin expectations, production costs, insurance, advertising, all these things are affected by the price that you ultimately set, but they also formed the conditions that you took into account when making your original determination of where you should set the price. So in the end, you're cutting a bit of the loop. When no matter what you decide, it affects the original decisions as well. For what it's worth, I think Fuller is right. Polycentricity is a feature of our world, and especially of the legal world. And I think it's very fair to say that in the UK, this idea still holds sway in courtrooms and in the imagination and description that we encounter in scholarship. It gives courts a certain unease, I think, about scrutinizing government policy too closely, especially when there are resource implications and distribution implications. When it comes to polycentric issues, Fuller thought that courts were uniquely ill-suited to evaluating such cases. Why? Because he said, well, they only hear two sides of the argument. They only get input from the party that wants the claim to succeed and the party that wants the claim to be defeated. Consequently, the court must also make all or nothing decisions. It either finds in favor of the claimant or of the other party. And this is the crucial thing for him. He says what courts do in order to manage polycentric issues, they try to recast them into familiar patterns of decision-making and try to make them fit, shoehorn them, if you will, into the characteristics of legal decision-making. I think he's right, but I strongly disagree that this is something that is unique to courts. And I think if we take Fuller's argument about polycentricity seriously, as I think we should, then it has implications for virtually any form of decision-making that we can come up with. So Parliament, for instance, recasts very complicated policy issues in terms that suits its decision-making process. Governments do the same thing, executive bodies, environmental regulatory organizations, you name it, they all do this. They try to take a very complicated, interconnected world that is very difficult for any individual or any organization to fully comprehend, and they try to simplify it down into a decision-making structure that they are much more comfortable with. Everyone does this. And I think while courts also do it, it doesn't really make the argument out that we should be particularly worried about courts. More importantly, I think there are myths operating in the background, especially when it comes to resource allocation cases. What's more persuasive, or the persuasive part that I would like to keep from Fuller, if you will, is that we should really be careful about letting courts making very radical change. So the more radical the change to the legal system, the further we move away from these fundamental commitments that we've made to human rights and the rule of law, the more it is required that there's democratic accountability and input. Now, I'm not one who says that courts don't have democratic legitimacy. I think they do. It's just not a direct legitimacy. But I think the further we move away from these basic assumptions and the things that flow from them, the more I think it's necessary for direct democratic input through Parliament and through the democratic process. That is not to say that courts should not be bold in their interpretation of the law, as long as it can be justified on the basis of these fundamental commitments.
But let's remove ourselves from this entertaining arena and turn to what most people think of as the core of civil law, the battle between individual victims accusing other individuals of doing them harm. This is known as the law of negligence, and more specifically, in the cases we're going to reprise in this episode, clinical negligence litigation. As Emma says, whilst experts make mistakes, not every error they make is in breach of their duty of care. Our LawPod UK co-presenter, Emma Louise Fenlon, is very much a specialist in this area, and she waved down clinical negligence expert Margaret Bauer on Casey of One Crown Office Row to discuss the fraught practical subject of expert evidence in these cases. Emma and Margaret's episode is strikingly called Disaster Avoidance for Experts, and is, I may say, imperative listening for practitioners in this area. One has to be careful about what one opines on as an expert, but equally, you as counsel taking evidence have to be sensitive as to the questions that you put. Another interesting lesson for practitioners arose from the cautionary tale of Andrews and Chronospan Limited. Incidentally, all the citations for the cases referred to in this episode can be found on our human rights blog under the relevant episode title. There was a joint expert meeting, and following this, it became apparent that the claimant's expert, Dr. Gibson, had been in touch with the claimant's solicitor, and in 16 instances, the claimant's solicitor had made suggestions on the matter of substance. Unsurprisingly, this was held to be a serious transgression of the rules on joint meetings. The claimant argued that it would be disproportionate to allow for the evidence of Dr. Gibson, given the expense and delay that would inevitably cause. They suggested it should go to the weight of his evidence rather than admissibility.
That didn't find favour with Senior Master Fontaine, who concluded that the claimant could not rely on the evidence of Dr. Gibson. And really what comes out of the judgment is that the court was very concerned, the master, who has huge experience, was concerned that the impression was that Dr. Gibson had become or was becoming something of an advocate for the claimant. And that, of course, is a feature that one does come across. And he'd rather sort of stepped aside from what should be his fundamental role, and that's as an independent expert whose primary obligation is to the court. And also he was very concerned that the solicitors for the claimant had been rather reluctant to reveal the full extent of the communications, and he was plainly very troubled by all of that.
The importance of experts also featured on the episode discussion on multi-defendant cases in a clinical negligence context. When discussing the disadvantages for claimants suing multiple defendants, I took a deep dive into the fundamentals of multi-defendant cases. I sought out the expertise of Cara Guthrie and Matthew Flynn, both barristers at One Crown Office Row. As Cara explains, it's not necessarily in the interests of a claimant to sue more than one defendant. You want to keep a claim as streamlined as possible. Where legal responsibility for a causative chain of events is broken could be the subject of an entire podcast episode in itself, but I wanted to focus on the potential downsides for a claimant taking a claim against more than one defendant.
Well, the main problem, if you sue more than one defendant, is that they might all gang up against you. So the defendants can cooperate with each other. So they can agree to share information with each other before they share it with the claimant. So sometimes defendants will agree to exchange pleadings with each other on a without prejudice basis, or they might agree to exchange their factual and expert evidence prior to service. And the advantage for defendants of that cooperative approach is it means that they all get a greater understanding of the case as a whole. And so all the defendants can see where the strengths and weaknesses of all the parties are. And for example, if one defendant takes a pleading point and the other defendant thinks, yes, that's a good point, that defendant can choose to plead the same point, even though it didn't occur to them at the beginning. And that sort of has the effect of reinforcing the point being made by the original defendant. Or, you know, sometimes one defendant gets a report that is supportive of the defendants, and the other defendant might have obtained an unsupportive report. But in those circumstances, the second defendant can choose to rely on the first defendant's report, so the claimant will never know that there was an expert that had actually agreed with the claimant's expert in that case. It doesn't always happen, but one defendant can invite his experts to comment on the allegations made against the co-defendant. And so you can have two lots of experts saying that the criticisms made by the claimant are unfounded. And then finally, even if both defendants are in fact critical of each other, they could agree to keep those criticisms to themselves so that they don't prejudice their positions vis-a-vis the claimant. And you can imagine in a case where the two defendants have provided similar types of care. So I've got a case at the moment which is about wound management. Was a wound bandaged appropriately? And the claimant is criticising a dermatology unit, some GP nurses and community nurses. And in that case, all three defendants' experts are saying what we did reflected a reasonable standard of care. And you can see that a judge, when applying the Bolam test, will be very unlikely to conclude that all of them is wrong. And then you can have the same point on causation. You know, it might be that all the defendants' experts give evidence saying that the claimant's injuries was the inevitable consequence of his or her underlying condition rather than having been caused by any negligence.
There are potential advantages to suing multiple defendants. One defendant may end up opposing another defendant's position, thereby supporting the claimant's case. Or, if all the defendants acknowledge that they are at risk of losing a case, they may decide to settle on terms favourable to the claimant so as to share liability between them.
Now we move on to inquests and verdicts of unlawful killing. The history of the relationship between the criminal and coronial courts is an interesting one. Inevitably, coroners are charged with how and when someone died. And the when, where, and how are inextricably tied up with the criminal jurisdiction. As a result of this historical hangover, we still have the verdict of unlawful killing in coronial inquests. Emma Louise Fenlon asked Matthew Hill of One Crown Office Row about the availability of a finding of unlawful killing in an inquest that takes place after a criminal trial with a jury acquittal. How can a verdict of not guilty segue into a finding of unlawful killing? Is this going to create some kind of existential crisis between these two jurisdictions, as Emma suggests?
I think in your blog post, you come up with the terrific phrase Schrodinger's defendants and the idea that we are increasingly going to see inquests and inquest findings where this phenomenon appears. Those who the courts have found to not be guilty of the homicide of the person that they are then found they unlawfully killed.
For those practicing in the coroner's courts and having to abide by the judgment in Morm, the feeling is that this is about acquittals in criminal trials. This isn't an opportunity for those who have been convicted in the magistrate's court to get an acquittal. Also, the criminal court hasn't provided an answer as to precisely how the victim died. In most cases, there is at least an argument that the coronial procedure is worth returning to for opening up this inquiry. As Matt says, the final point is whether the coroner's courts will identify the person who is said to have committed the unlawful killing.
I can see an argument that because the coroner is no longer making a determination on the criminal standard, then he or she can't be seen to be appearing to determine a matter of criminal liability. A rather wordy way of saying that this might all be up for grabs as well. In which case, I can see how the family of a victim may wish to seek to persuade a coroner that statutory prohibition no longer applies because of Morm. And therefore, not only can you make a finding of unlawful killing, but you can make a finding of unlawful killing by Mr. X. And that will be a reversion to a situation which hasn't happened in England and Wales, at least, since the 1970s. It's often said that the last person who coroner's court found named to be guilty of a homicide offence was Lord Lucan. Now, I'm not sure if that's right, but certainly there has been a prohibition on naming anybody as being responsible for unlawful killing since 1977.
There is now a question as to whether that's going to hold. As Emma Louise says, the law feels quite cutting edge here. For example, questions of corporate manslaughter are on the table, or cases that fall into a grey area where, for example, someone might have been acquitted of murder but found guilty of some lesser offence that touches on the victim's death. In those circumstances, how does that affect a submission that unlawful killing is an appropriate ruling, and indeed that person should be formally named on the record? Well, that's it for our roundup of the pre-summer episodes of LawPod UK, or at least the most prominent ones. We're already back to school, as it were, with our family law experts discussing vulnerable witnesses in the family courts. That episode went out on the 30th of August, if you're interested in listening. And we have plenty of interesting and forward-looking material coming up for this autumn and winter. Keep tuning in.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row and Podcasts for Lawyers.